Well, if you have a Bible with you, I'd invite you to turn to the book of James as we continue in our series this morning through this book, which, as I shared last week, is part of a larger series that we're really focusing in on this year at Summit Ridge, and that is really acting and living like the church. And we have been in the midst of this book looking at what it means for us to act as Christians and collectively as a church. And James, as I shared last week, I'll share it with you this week, is all prescriptive. It is not simply describing. It is actually telling us this is how we should act. This is how we should behave, kind of thing. And so as we look at this book of James, and particularly even this passage and passages before and passages to come after, my encouragement to all of us is to look at this and say, this is what James is encouraging us to do, okay? And so this morning, as James has been building up a case that he is now, in many ways, is going to share as to why he has built up this case, as beginning with the power of the tongue, and then understanding just how incredibly powerful our tongues are, and the words that we speak, and the words that we share, and the impact it can have on so many people around us, whether good or not, is incredibly underestimated. The tongue is incredibly powerful, and yet it is so small. But that is usually the case, that things that seem so insignificant are in reality incredibly important, and the tongue is no different. And last week we looked at, as a result of understanding the power of the tongue, that we have a choice. We can either adopt the world's wisdom, which seeks to amp up the volume or the intensity of arguments and disagreements, to really kind of throw gasoline, if you will, on the fire of tension and conflict, or we can choose to practice kingdom wisdom, which seeks to kind of dial the temperature down, to seek to kind of make peace. And so we can have a choice in the midst of that of how we want to proceed when we are find ourselves in situations that may not be exactly peaceful. And so this morning, we're going to look at another aspect of this, and that is looking at how we talk to each other. And not only that, how we talk about each other. Because here's the thing I want to share with all of you this morning. How we talk to each other and about each other often reveals who we really are, and whether or not we realize it, who God is, right or wrong. In other words, how we speak to each other and how we speak about each other is more of a testimony about what we believe who God is, whether or not we realize it. That's why this is so important for us to understand this morning. And so we're kind of continuing on this whole thing of what James has been building up to. And this morning, we're going to look at only two verses. That's it. Two verses. I know, don't get too excited yet. Don't get too excited. Rob and Christy, as last week, they gave me some extra time this morning. And so that's good. It may not be for you all. Just remember, what you say matters. But I'm not the one listening. Jesus is. Anyways, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. We're going to look at two verses. And although these verses are short, I believe that these verses are very long in depth in sharing about the necessity and the importance of being of having a great understanding of how it is and the impact we have of how we talk to each other and how we talk about each other. And this morning, we're going to simply look at these two verses because I think for James, perhaps more than any other way, that the battle within that we are constantly fighting, whether or not to amp up the intensity of a disagreement, whether or not to say something that might make us feel good in the short run, but in the long run can do great damage, or whether or not to dial it back and to be, you know, maybe not say anything, or maybe just to say something that helps bring more peace to a very tense situation, is that perhaps the most prominent way that we can see conflict arise in churches, never mind anywhere else, and it does happen everywhere else, but I'm just going to focus in on the church this morning because that's where we are, and that's whom James is writing to, is that all of a sudden now we can discover that perhaps the most hurtful things, the most conflict-ridden things that happen in churches is oftentimes what is said to one another. Is what is said to one another. The things I have heard Christians, and I am just as guilty at times, that have, the way that, the things that Christians have said to one another, I am just in some ways shocked. Just shocked at some of the hurtful things that brothers and sisters in Christ have said to each other, believing that they are telling the truth. And that telling the truth is the quintessential aim of Christians. We have to tell it like it is, right? Let me just share something with you that a friend of mine, Randall, oftentimes says. You can be right and still have to sleep on the couch. Doesn't matter if you're right in the long run. It doesn't matter. You can be right. And in the process of being right, you could have alienated and destroyed relationships in the process. And what have you gained? Nothing. Nothing. You know, I am convinced of this. Jesus did not come to this earth to simply be right. He came to this earth to show us how to live right with each other. I mean, that's that we have to remember. And let me just say something like this. And I've said this before and I'll share it again. The thing about Jesus is, and I understand that we look at Jesus, he is our model, this is who we are supposed to be like and everything else, but there, let's just be honest about the fact that Jesus is perfect, sinless, and we are not. And there are some things that we ought to leave in Jesus' corner and let other things, you know, let him decide that, and then for the rest of us, let's just not try to emulate that because we're not Jesus in the end. So that's really quite significant. How we treat each other by the way we speak to one another speaks incredible volumes about who we are as a church. And like I said before, more conflict like that has ripped churches apart than almost any other thing. So this morning, I want us to take a look at what James writes about this. And as we do, there are two dangers that I think James points out for us that I think are important for us to take a look at. He's going to take the negative part of this, by the way, of speaking. It's called slandering, all that kind of stuff. We're going to dive more into that. But listen to what James writes just in these verses, verses 11 and 12 of chapter 4. He says this, do not speak against one another. Now, some of your translations might say, do not slander, do not speak evil, whatever. Same thing. Do not speak against one another, brothers and sisters. He who speaks against a fellow believer or judges a fellow believer speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but its judge. But there is only one who is a lawgiver and judge, and the one who is able to save and destroy. On the other hand, who are you to judge your neighbor? Make sense? Right? How many times have we heard, do not judge? Now, I struggle with that, okay? I mean, let me just say this, and we'll get into more of this. I want to distinguish between saying, judging between what is right and wrong. As a parent, I can tell you, I could tell my kids, that was wrong, this was right. That's appropriate. That's appropriate. You have to be able to say, parents, you have permission, not from me. Who am I? Nobody. But from the Word of God, to parent your children in a way that is God-honoring. And part of that is to say, listen, this is not right. This is right. This is wrong. This is right. That's not the judgment that James is referring to, as we're going to find out in just a little bit. So don't mistake what it's saying here. So if you, you know, don't go away and say to your kids, I can't judge you anymore. I am not saying that, okay? No, no, no. You need to parent your kids, all that kind of stuff. If you're an employer and you have people under you who work for you, and you have certain standards by which you do things, by the which way you run your company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or if you're simply a manager as well, and you have people under your authority, there are times that you say, listen, this is wrong, i.e., this is illegal. We can't do this. That's okay. That's not what James is referring to here, okay? We're going to find out here in just a minute what he's referring to. But let me say this. The first danger, I said there were two, that James cites when we speak against each other, when we slander each other, when we speak evil against each other, the first danger that we can run into is that we ruin or distort or slander God's law and message. Now, what is God's law? Right? You might think of the Ten Commandments. Yeah, that's a good start. Let's boil it down to what Jesus said. He boiled it down to simply two things: love God and love each other. That's it. That's it. Love God and love each other. When we slander people, we distort that message. We distort that message. And by the way, Christians can be really good at slandering each other. I shared last week about Martin Luther. He was quite an incredibly biting wit about him, tongue as well as pen. And I shared last week that there are things on the web that you can go to that you can ask Martin Luther to insult you, and he will. Certain sayings. Let me just share with you some of the things that he wrote that I think, whew, they're rough. He says this, one of the things he writes: may your grain spoil in the barn, your beer in the cellar, your cattle perish in the stall. Yes, your entire hoard ought to be consumed by rust so that you will never enjoy it. Man. That was a preacher, theologian, professor, starter of the Reformation. Here's another thing he said: you deserve not only to be given no food to eat, but also to have the dog set upon you and to be pelted with horse manure. Man. Your words, he writes, are so foolishly and ignorantly composed that I cannot believe you understand them. Let me just say this, brothers and sisters, if you haven't figured it out already, Martin Luther was not a perfect person, was he? He had some issues. He had some big issues. But let me just say this, that is true for all of us as it was for Martin Luther. God draws straight lines with crooked sticks. We're not perfect, but God still uses us. God still uses us. So I just wanted to share that. We can slander each other like no one else can. And we do it in a very sinister way. I've heard it done in so many different ways. I have a prayer request. I want you to pray for so-and-so. This person has made and just goes off. And what is a couch in a prayer request is actually gossip. But we can put it in flowery language. You might as well just say, you know, give out this whole thing about gossip and just end it with bless your heart. Right? As though saying that at the end makes everything else you said before it okay. It doesn't. You see, we as Christians are really good at being able to couch things in flowery spiritual language so that it doesn't seem as though we're slandering someone or gossiping about someone, but in actuality, we really are. But we say it so we can feel good about sharing it. We're really good at this, church. We're really good at this. And it's really destructive. I mean, this is the thing, that when we say these things, when we slander someone, and by the way, slandering someone is simply defined as this. It is simply this, is to speak evil against someone, and it is essentially a statement that diminishes a person's worth and harms them, often irreparably. That's the core of what slander does. It diminishes a person's worth and often harms them irreparably. If you think about the things that have been said by Christians towards those who may not even know Jesus, let alone those who do, it is awful. Such as things I have heard and seen and written. You know, you're going to hell if you do that. You know, you're going to hell if you do that. Oh, God hates you. The only reason why God even wants to entertain you in his presence is because of his son, Jesus Christ. We take the idea that of sin and brokenness, and it is awful and absolutely horrible and a very much a matter of our life, no doubt. But we take that idea and we take it to the extreme and say that God looks at us without Jesus and he hates us. He hates you. We say things like this: you are not loved. God doesn't love you. You are not loved. You're a failure. You're a mistake. That's slander. That is taking someone's worth and diminishing it. Let me just say this. It's one thing to declare that something is right or wrong. Stealing, lying, murder, adultery, idolatry, etc. Go down the list. As I shared before, that's not what James is referring to. It's another, however, to devalue someone because of what they did. That's wrong. That's what James is referring to here. That's the judgment that James is talking about that we should not be doing. It's not wrong to declare something right or wrong. It is wrong to devalue someone who did something wrong. That's wrong. That's devaluing. This is what he's getting at. That is what slander is all about. Now, here's the thing. Slander can be multi-dynamic. There is not just one simple way that we can slander each other. James, perhaps more than any other book in the New Testament, pulls from the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' greatest teachings. And so I want us to take a look. There is a section in the Sermon on the Mount that I could not help but think maybe James was thinking about when he wrote this. By the way, he's writing this to Christians. Don't slander each other, because he knew there was slandering going on. Don't slander each other. And so all of a sudden now, I cannot help to think that as he was writing this, that maybe he was thinking about the Sermon on the Mount, specifically where Jesus is talking specifically about slandering. And we find that in Matthew 5. And from there, we can kind of look at the different ways that we can slander other people and not maybe even realize it. Let me give you an example. Matthew 5, verses 21 through 22. Matthew 5, verses 21 through 22. This one, it might be a familiar verse to you. But I want to read it for you anyways, and I'm talking so I can find my place here real quick. I am delaying, and that's intentional. I admit it. Here's what Jesus says here. You have heard that it was said to an older generation, do not murder, and whoever murders will be subjected to judgment. But I say to you that anyone who is angry with a brother will be subjected to judgment. And whoever insults a brother will be brought before the council, and whoever says fool, or maybe some of your translations might say raka, will be sent to fiery hell. Now, raka is this terminology that means simply empty-headedness. That means dumb. That means, dare I say, even kind of, you maybe have heard the phrase, dumber than a box of rocks. That diminishes a person's value, because they're made in the image of God. That diminishes a person. This, and Jesus speaks it. In other words, one of the ways that we can slander is the most obvious way, is that we can speak it to someone. We can look at someone and we can just say, you're a fool. You are just, you got no brains. You are not very bright. You are not the sharpest tool in the shed, etc. All of the euphemisms that we use to describe someone who isn't very smart, right? That is the most common way that we can slander someone. Here's another way. And it's with our thoughts. Jesus goes on in Matthew 5 and says this, you have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to desire her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better to lose one of your members than to have your whole body thrown into hell. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better to lose one of your members than to have your whole body go into hell. In other words, even thinking thoughts, lustful thoughts, towards another person is devaluing their personhood. Looking at them as objects. That is slander. That is slander. No wonder Jesus, and this is a euphemism, by the way, it's not taken literally. All right? Basically, Jesus says, if you get to that point, don't look and don't touch. Okay? Do not objectify people. That is wrong. It is absolutely wrong. So we can do that with our thoughts. We can slander people with our own thoughts. Here's another way that we can slander people, and it's by our actions. Matthew 5, 31 through 37. And this one I'll be honest with you, have struggled with this passage. But I'm going to read it anyways. It was said, whoever divorces his wife must give her a legal document. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for immorality makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Ooh, right? Some of you got puzzled looks on your face. The woman has done nothing wrong, and yet she commits adultery? What does that mean? Perhaps there are two prominent, not the only ones, but two prominent ways to understand this. And both can be accepted and both are compatible with each other. They're not inconsistent. You can hold both views and you're fine with that. One is, perhaps, and back in Jesus' day, the way that you got a divorce is the husband would initiate it. That's just how it was, okay? In Jesus' day among the Jewish community. And basically what was going on here is that there was a rendering of the understanding of Deuteronomy where this passage comes out of that Jesus quotes, whoever divorces his wife must give her a legal document, was a twisting of that, that all of a sudden now a husband could divorce his wife for any reason that he thought was good. Oh, you burnt my toast this morning. Getting a divorce. You didn't pick up my dry cleaning this week. I'm divorcing you. Whatever it is, I don't know. You know, it's just whatever it is. It was taken to diminish the value of marriage, but more than that, it was a devaluing of the wife, who in Jesus' day relied on her husband for support and protection as was needed. And so oftentimes, one definition or one way of looking at this is to say that what happens when a divorce occurs other than immorality is that a woman now who is now single finds herself vulnerable. And while she can go back to her family, that certainly is an option, all that kind of great stuff, chances are she might get remarried again. And in doing so, the bond of the marriage has never been broken for the first one because adultery was not committed. Here's a second one, and this one I'm more leaning towards as well, is that because of what the husband has done here in divorcing his wife, leaving her vulnerable, is that not only is she vulnerable to be taken advantage of, but now she lives under the shadow of his sin and is devalued because of it. Is devalued because of it. That's a form of slander, devaluing people. Jesus says this going on in verse 33, again, you have heard that it was said to an older generation, do not break an oath, but fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, do not take oaths at all. Not by heaven, because it is the throne of God. Not by earth, because it is footstool. And not by Jerusalem, because it is the city of the great king. Do not take an oath by your head, because you are not able to make one hair white or black. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. No more of this from the evil one. Now, don't make commitments that you can't keep. You don't know what it's going to be like. You can't make things happen the way that maybe you think you can. I can't do that. You know what I realize is just how little of control I am in every single time. I'm just in so little of control of anything. What other people do, I can't control people. I don't know how many times I have had people come to me in counseling sessions, and basically in the counseling session, by the way, I'm a really bad counselor, so don't come and see me. I'm really bad at it. I do three sessions and I'm out. I'll refer you. I just know my limits. But oftentimes, counseling sessions isn't about the person who wants to kind of dive more deeply into their stuff. What they want to do is they want to fix the other person that they have a problem with. And as soon as I kind of discover that's probably where this is going, I stop them and I say, guess what? You can't change that other person. You can't control that other person, so let it go. The only thing you can control is yourself. So don't make commitments using God's name in a way that you now have to fulfill it. And if you don't, you slander his covenant and his great name. Which is why I love part of the aspect of our brethren church heritage here is that one of our three negatives that we call it is non-swearing. Now, some of you might think, oh, don't swear. That's not what that means. Oh, that's a good policy to have. Don't swear. That's a really good thing to have. What we mean by that is we do not take oaths. We let our yes be yes and our no be no. We do not swear on anything because we can't control it. We can only control ourselves. We can't control what other people may do. And so these are the three most common ways I think we can slander. We can slander with our words, our thoughts, and our actions. And it's incredibly hurtful. So that's the first danger. The first danger is that we diminish or distort God's law and message. Here's the second negative or the second danger. We can negatively impact a person's destiny or future by our words, by the things we say that are untrue, by the things we say that are slanderous. We can impact negatively a person's destiny and future. You hear about sometimes these stories all the time about people who had an accusation made against them that turned out to not be true. And it was a serious accusation. For the rest of their lives, they have to live under the cloud of that accusation, even though it wasn't true. For the rest of their lives, they have to suffer needlessly because of what someone else said about them that turned out to not be true. We live in a culture today where what someone says can be posted on the internet within seconds. And by the way, do not believe that once you post something, you can take it off. It is there forever. Forever. Things we say about each other. The one thing, and I'll be honest with you, I'm not a big social media user, and I'm much happier for it. I've got thoughts about that. I'm not going to say anything. I'll slander, no. But you know what really breaks my heart is what really, really drove me is that what people would say about others on social media. What people would say about others, family members, fellow Christians, friends, is just so hurtful. And here's the thing, it's in print. It lasts forever. You can't take that back. Someone can print that off and have that. And it is devastating whether or not we realize it. What we say to a person can impact their destiny and their future. And if we're communicating to them that God hates you, that you are going to hell, what kind of impact do you think that has on a person's life? What kind of impact do you think it has on a person's life if they are told they are a failure, that they're not very smart? They live under the cloud of that perspective probably for the remainder of their life. When I was in youth group, right, we had a rule. And that is if anybody said anything negative to someone, they had to give them 10 positive statements in return, right? Why? Well, one reason was to make sure that they understood that, first of all, saying that was not good. But secondly, to try to counteract the negativity of that one statement. Do you know how successful that was? Not very. Think about it. How many of us have been in situations where someone will just share, all these people will share wonderful things about us. Maybe we did a great job at something. But there's that one person who gives just an incredibly negative, hurtful comment. And that's the one that sticks. That's the one that sticks. Never mind that there are 15 other ones that say just how wonderful you are. It's the one comment that someone says that is negative and hurtful that sticks with you often for the rest of your life. It's devastating. Brothers and sisters, do you realize we have that kind of influence, that kind of power? That we can help, whether negatively or positively, impact a person's destiny or future? Do you realize that we have that kind of sway? We really do. There is something in the scriptures that has been called the elusive blessing. I've talked about this before. I'll talk about it again. And that is the blessing of a father to his son. You see it with Abraham. You see it with Isaac, with Jacob and Esau. You see it with Jacob, with his sons, in which all of a sudden now all these sons want is the blessing of their dad. And really what these sons, what the blessing is just simply a father to say to his son, "Son, I am so proud of you. I am so proud of you." I'm a political junkie. I shared that last week. Should be nothing new. Let me just say this. There are people in this world today that want to visit every baseball park in the country, right? My goal is to visit every presidential museum in the country, right? I think I've seen about 6 of them, and I love it. But you know what is interesting in being in these presidential museums? Is that many of the presidents, and I'm talking about the most recent ones because presidential museums didn't come into existence until FDR, maybe Teddy Roosevelt, maybe as early as that. But oftentimes, if they always have a replica of the Oval Office, and you can sit, oftentimes I got to sit behind the desk and all that, and it's usually an exact replica. It's usually the Resolute desk, which there's a great history on that, but I'm not going to go into that because that's boring. I think it's fascinating, and I love our country, so... Just kidding. I do love our country. Anyways, how many of the presidents And they're on the back part of their desk, not on the front part, but the behind them, they have portraits. And oftentimes, the most prominent portrait is of their father. Of their father. I think of President George W. Bush when he was inaugurated, the very first person he had into the Oval Office, right after he got in there, after he was inaugurated, after watching the parade, after going into the Oval Office, was no one else except his dad. It was the very first picture. Former President Trump, if you noticed, behind his desk was a picture prominently displayed of his own father. So many men, and I'm one of them. I would have loved, here's the thing with my own father. My father, God bless him, he wasn't around when I was growing up. I grew up in my mom raised me and my two siblings. And we saw my dad, every other weekend visit thing. And I didn't want to see my dad. I didn't know my dad very much. And I couldn't relate to my dad. My dad and I were the exact opposite of each other. He liked country music, and I think country music is awful. He would wear cowboy boots and a hat, and now I'm thinking about cowboy boots, but I'm certainly not thinking about a hat. And he liked to do all, we were just very much opposites. But it was the one thing that my dad did that I didn't realize how important it was, I still have it to this day, is he wrote me a letter. He was just sharing about his life, and he was just sharing how much he was proud of me. And I didn't realize it, but several weeks later, he would be killed in a car accident. And so I look at that letter, and I think, thank goodness I have something in writing that's permanent. My dad never wrote a thing, but he wrote this. He wrote this. And by the way, my dad was under a cloud of people who told him he wasn't very smart. My dad was a good man. He wasn't a perfect man, but he was a good man. We can negatively impact a person's destiny or future by what we say. That's what can happen. So fathers, I share this again, I'll share it again. Tell your sons you're proud of them. Tell your sons you love them. And do it often. Don't make that blessing elusive. Don't make those sons regret and yearn for a blessing that for whatever reason they may not get. Tell them, I don't care how old they are, by the way, tell them. I try to make it a point to tell my son that as often as I can. It's to the point now that my son jokes about it. I know, Dad. Good. Because you're a punk otherwise. No. I'm just kidding. Any of you who know my son, he's great. He really is. I'm proud of all my kids. Truly am. Is it no wonder that God hates slander? Proverbs 6, 16 through 19 says this. There are six things that the Lord hates, even seven things that are an abomination. Horrible to him, haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift to run to evil, a false witness who pours out lies, and a person who spreads discord among family members. That's all slander. That's all slander. God hates that. He really does. It's an abomination to him. I love what Socrates said. He said this, strong minds discuss ideas. Average minds discuss events. Weak minds discuss people. I don't think any one of us here are weak-minded at all. At all. So what do? I titled today's message, Trash the Trash Talk. Trash the Trash Talk. Let us be different. I love what Ephesians chapter 4, verses 29 through 32 share. And the Apostle Paul writes the following. You must let no unwholesome word come out of your mouth, but only what is beneficial for the building up of the one in need, that it would give grace to those who hear. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. You must put away all bitterness, anger, wrath, quarreling, and slanderous talk. Indeed, all malice. Instead, be kind to one another, compassionate, forgiving one another, just as God in Christ also forgave you. I don't know how to say this, but perhaps for me, one of the things I have learned that helps is I want to look back at my life, and I heard someone share this, and it made sense to me. And this person said, it is not the things that I said that I'm most proud of. It's the things I didn't say. Sometimes I need to just not say anything if I can't say anything nice at all. I need a if you will, some sort of protection, if you will, some sort of mechanism that prevents me from saying anything that may not be beneficial. You've heard this, I have a motorcycle. It's a trike. I'm not ashamed. And one of the things about this trike is I took it up to Mount Lemmon a few weeks ago for a pastor's retreat, and I was going up there, and I could not figure out on some of the curves, and there's some good twisties on Mount Lemmon, and as I was going around it, that my bike would kind of shimmy and shake, and I couldn't accelerate. I was like, what's going on here? Come on, let's go, you know? And I happened to look down at one of the times it was doing this, and I noticed that it had a display that came up that said losing traction, or it had a icon that was essentially losing tracking. So what my bike did is it slowed down regardless if I was going to accelerate or not. It said you will not go faster. They call that a nanny mode. A nanny mode. Someone to say, not going to do that, right? I think sometimes when it comes to us sharing with each other and talking with each other, sometimes we need to have a nanny mode. No. Just because you might be right doesn't mean you have to share it. Just because it is truthful doesn't need to be shared right then and there, and perhaps not in the way that maybe you want to say it to make yourself feel better. It might be better to share it later on, but maybe not in the heat of the moment. That's dialing down the temperature. It's not beneficial in that moment. By the way, people oftentimes will not hear each other when they're in arguments. No one's mind has ever been transformed in the midst of an argument. I have never heard a presidential debate in which two candidates all of a sudden are arguing with each other and the other one finally looks and says, you know what, you're right. I think I'm going to start doing that. In the history of our country, that has not happened. It has not happened. We need to stop the slandering, the negative talk, the backbiting, the things we say to each other that are not beneficial, and the things we say about each other when other people are not around, when those people are not around. We need to stop that and instead think about what it is that we're doing. Think about what it is that we're saying and ask ourselves, do I really need to say that right now? Can I hold off? I think Mother Teresa offers one of the best ways about doing this. She writes the following, or said this. These are the few ways we can practice humility, which I think is key here. James also wrote about that. To speak as little as possible of oneself. To mind one's own business. Now there's something. Not to want to manage other people's affairs. To avoid curiosity in the negative way. Not that there's a positive thing to curiosity. That's wonderful. To accept contradictions and correction cheerfully. Have you ever had someone correct you, and maybe you responded by saying, you know what, you're right. Thank you. Try it. To pass over the mistakes of others, to accept insults and injuries, to accept being slighted, forgotten, and disliked, to be kind and gentle, even under provocation, never to stand on one's dignity, and finally, and this is the hardest, to choose always the hardest. So this morning, we're going to prepare to receive communion. And Jesus shared in Matthew 5 in the midst of calling someone Raca. He says this, if you have a grievance against someone, go to that person. Leave your offering Leave your offering. Go to that person and make it right. And then come and share. I understand that communion is, in many ways, one of these things that we do out of perhaps habit, routine. It's one of the ordinances that Jesus gave to the church to do. And so sometimes we can take it for granted. Sometimes we can just simply say, oh, it's Communion Sunday. Here we go. Let's just take communion. It's wonderful. But I want to challenge us, and this is my struggle every time that we do this, is to understand that this is holy. This is what sets us apart as Christians. This is the one thing that as Christians that we do that only Christians should do. That only Christians should do. Because it is that precious. It is the reconciling work of Jesus Christ in our lives so we can be saved, so we can be made whole, so we can have a relationship with the Father, so we can know this without a doubt. And I want you all to hear this. God loves you. God treasures you. God died for you. That's how much He loves us. And if you're here today and you think you're a failure, I want to tell you, you're not. You're not a failure. You are worth dying for.